That's an edge, and that's gone. Hey, he does play it, that one. Tim Robinson had been brought up inside the circle. It's paid dividends. Hamish Bennett strikes. It's 11 for 2.
This is Through the Pickets, a podcast proudly brought to you by the New Zealand Cricket Players Association, where we showcase our members' interests, achievements and experiences either side of the white picket fence, with more of a lens on their off-field endeavours. Today's episode features a man who began his career in Canterbury in 2005, before moving to Wellington in 2016, collecting 489 wickets in his 265 domestic matches. Debuting for the Black Caps in 2010, he made 31 appearances for New Zealand across all three formats, taking 43 wickets with best figures of 4 for 16 v Kenya. And having recently retired, Hamish Bennett has packed up the family and moved to Queensland to start the next phase of his career.
Oh, there it goes again. Is there an edge? Yes, there is. Yes, the finger goes up and Bennett's got the big scalp of Guptill. Oh, has he got it? Chew, has he got it? No, he hasn't. Finds the fielder. Nice, comfortable catch. It's Bracewell. And Hamish Bennett picks up the final wicket, and he deserved it because that last over was sensational.
Former Black Cap, Wellington and Canterbury pace bowler Hamish Bennett, welcome to Through the Pickets. Really good to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us. Now, Hamish, a bit of news since your retirement, mate. You've headed across the Tasman into Queensland. So, mate, what are you up to?
Well, g'day, Dennis. Well, thanks for having me on for a start. Always good to, obviously been a bit of a listener of Through the Pickets, so always good to be on as a guest. Yeah, made the move over to Australia. You know, obviously the other half's Australian, so haven't seen the family in a long time due to COVID and sort of the way the world's been. So we thought we'd had an opportunity just to get involved with the coaching of sort of younger players and coaching some of the coaches in the region as well. So for Southeast Queensland. So I just thought that was a good opportunity. So why not take it, basically, was the reasoning behind that.
How did it come about, Hamish?
I just saw the job online, to be honest, and just went through the process of applying and the interview stages. And I was fortunate enough to get it. So no real big science behind it, just doing the old school, just applying when you see a job and then just going from there.
Having played cricket professionally for 17 years, it's a bit different. Like, did you have the nervousness that people like myself, fairly new job applicants, have?
I guess I've been through a few job applications, a couple in cricket and a couple in the real world, I guess, and had missed out on some jobs. So you're always nervous when you're going for jobs and stuff. I don't think it will ever leave. Yeah, it's just all part of the journey, I guess. Of, you know, you never had an interview to be an opening bowler or something like that. So I guess, it's just all part of it. It's just another, I guess, life skill and another challenge, really. That's why I wanted to come over, get into a new system, see how the Aussies thinking about cricket. And just, try and challenge myself to be a better coach.
Leah, your wife, what did she think about going back to Aussie? Is she from Queensland, or are you in a different part of Australia than where she's from? Or?
No, she's a Queenslander. So once a Queenslander, always a Queenslander. They love their weather, and they're always complaining about weather if it's sort of under 30 degrees. I mean, they're complaining at the moment because it's only 26 or 27 or something, that it's cold and it's not summer yet because it hasn't got hot. And yes, we had a few days which was over sort of 30 degrees, and they're like, you know, finally summer's here, we can actually get ready. But yeah, when it's sort of 27, 28, they're all still wearing pants and complaining how cold it is. So they're a different breed in that regard. They complain about the weather more than the English do.
I was going to say, you spend a decent chunk of your time in Wellington, mate. So, you know, on a good day, it's amazing. But on other days,
I'm absolutely melting. But compared to Wellington weather, and when they're like, oh, it's a bit windy, it's like, you haven't seen wind yet. But you could do with some of the Wellington wind over here on some of the warmer days especially. But it's good. It's just, it's just a different challenge of, you know, you don't have to. I think I've only worn pants twice while I've been here so far. One was for a fortunate enough to go to a welcome to country from the Black Caps for their warm-up games for the T20 World Cup. So I got invited along to that, so I had to, you know, get suited and booted. And then the other time was actually another Black Caps going to the game. With the tickets we got, I sort of had to wear pants to get into this area. So there's only two times I've worn pants is to go to watch the Black Caps play. So I guess that's the only time, hopefully, I'll have to wear pants, is whenever New Zealand comes to Brisbane.
Hey, what was the experience like, having been recently retired, going out and watching a team you've been involved with 31 times over your career?
I think I was more passionate last night after watching the semi-final and during the semi-final, like if yelling at the TV with a few comments and stuff. But when I was watching, I was pretty relaxed. When I retired, I wasn't forced into retirement. I knew when I was right, so I don't have any. I don't really have any things of thinking that I wish I was still playing or anything like that. Like at the moment, Queensland's playing Victoria, and they got them 8 for 45 at lunch or something. And you know, it's obviously a nice wicket to bowl on, but I'm not even thinking about bowling on it, you know, or not having any sort of, you know, regret or any sort of itchy feet or anything. When I made my decision, I was very happy with it, and I haven't thought about playing since.
It's interesting because a lot of players, they relive the moment. It's almost as if they're on the field and they're living it as if they're still playing.
Yeah, it can be a little bit like that. I think for me, I just look at the game now from a, I guess, from a coach's point of view, or I guess what would I be saying to the guys, or what messages would you be saying to the teams? I think that's where I'm sort of looking at it. Like, I mean, I've been pretty positive outlook really on the game. Like, the sun still gets up in the morning, you know, life still goes on. You know, like, I think that was the big thing for me. A couple of months after retiring, I remember thinking about games that we played that were really important to me, because a lot of people have asked me, you know, what's your most important moment and what are the games you wish you could take back and all that. And I didn't actually really care, like, now that we lost, or that we, you know, that, you know, I should have done that or I should have done this. Like, I think that's one thing for me that I want to take into my coaching career for, you know, the next generation, if I'm fortunate enough to get into a professional environment, is that, like, yeah, it sucks at the time. Remember the feeling, because that will help you train and make you motivated to get better and want to perform. And if it hurts, it should, you know, it just means you care. So that's a really positive thing. But don't try and hold on to it. I think, you know, a lot of the times I held on to stuff during my playing career that probably, you know, just wore me down eventually over time without knowing about it. So, yeah, for me, I would just be trying to reiterate that the sun still gets up, the world still moves. Quite a few people don't actually care that you won or lost yesterday or today. You just get on with it.
I might just have to cross those two questions off my list, mate. I know you've been bowling coach for the Blaze and a bowling advisor for Wellington. So did that plant the seed that, hey, coaching's a pathway I want to get into? Because you touched on, you apply for a couple of jobs in the real world as well. So are you happy to share what sort of industries or what areas you were looking at, or what sort of made you go in this direction?
Oh, I think coaching was always something that I think I definitely wanted to do and do want to do. And, yeah, fortunate enough to obviously be playing and you know, bowling coach of the Blaze and the Firebirds, players of interest in the under-19s as well with Wellington, and then do some stuff with New Zealand cricket with, you know, the under-19 males, and then sort of women's winter squads with the female stuff. So I've had a broad range of coaching while I was still playing, and also coached my club as well, so it was really enjoyable. I guess I put my name out there for other jobs just to see, I guess, I was in that dilemma, I guess, of, you know, do I try and stay in cricket or do I try and, I guess, do some stuff with Spark or SCNZ and on the side and get a real job. I went for jobs and, like, I guess, you know, some IT sales and a little bit in recruitment as well. But, yeah, I don't know. I just think at the end of the day, like, when I wake up, that I want to be a cricket coach. You know, I just got to, I don't know, I wake up, you know, and I think to myself, like, I'm in the right place. You know, I made the right decision. And I guess things happen for a reason. Things fall into place for reasons unknown. And sort of, I think it's fallen in place nicely for me at the moment. And, yeah, I guess, like, to, you know, to go back to one of your passions, Dennis, and football. You know, Roy Keane always says, and not that I sort of think like this, but I don't, but because I'm very appreciative of what Spark and SNZ have done for me and the people involved there. But Roy Keane, you know, when he was asked once, do you want to get back into Premier League coaching or stay a pundit on Sky? He said, well, I'm better than this, aren't I? Like, sitting on Sky talking about football, you know, I'm better than this, the game. I need to be involved in the game and I need to give back to the game, and I need to coach. I wake up every morning with a pit in my stomach and the voice in my head telling me that I need to coach. And I think that was a little bit like me, the voice in my head or the feeling in my stomach saying, you have to coach, you have to give it a go. Yeah, and I guess so once I, you know, hopefully I succeed, and if I fail, then I think I'll get into the real world, and then would love to obviously do the radio and the TV stuff as well to stay connected with the game. But I think for me, I had to give the coaching a go. Otherwise, I think I would have always, I think I would have missed the boat, and then I would have always thought to myself, what if? And then I would have probably always regretted it.
I'll come back to the coaching in a second, because I've told you personally that I think you're fantastic on air, and I've even told the producers at Spark Sport and that I thought you're fantastic. What did you enjoy about the role? Did you find, you know, like a lot of people having the whole production crew in your ear, a bit off-putting, where you're trying to have a conversation with your co-host and you can hear the producer calling different shots, or, you know, we're going to go to this next or that next?
Yeah, well, the radio is pretty easy, easier in that department, because you just talk to your producer. And you know, I was often with Dan McCarty, who was very sort of experienced and professional, so he knew what he was doing, and you're just sort of calling some expert stuff. The biggest thing is I found is actually getting the need that right chemistry between the commentators. Like if you've known them on a personal level, or you've had some conversations with them when you haven't been on air, and actually create a bit of a connection and sort of create your own rhythm between each other was what I found was pretty big. And like you said, with the TV stuff, yeah, like sometimes you just, you think to yourself, you put the mic down, you think to yourself, what did I just say? You can't even remember what you said, because you got your producer in the air, production in the air, then someone else is talking, and then you're talking, and then you're trying to listen to what your other commentator is trying to say, and you're trying to watch the game. So I think you just have to learn what your technique is. I mean, a lot of the guys just have one earpiece in the ear, and then the other one sort of free to listen to your commentator and sort of watch the game and see what's happening on your surroundings. But I think once you learn your cues of when your ad breaks are and when to and when Spark stays on air and when the rest of the world jump in and out, then once you learn that, it probably takes for me, it's probably a couple of Super Smash games to get my rhythm of that. So I was fortunate enough to do a couple of double header. So I felt after my double header on day one, I was good. And then day two, I sort of figured out the rhythm of it. It's one of those things that's pretty hard to sort of train for. I think you just have to get in there and just listen and just talk to people about those cues. And I mean, I was pretty, you know, fortunate. The rest of the commentary team were outstanding and trying to teach you and trying to help you on that. And they were pretty sort of driven and determined as well to make a really good product. So yeah, I've been lucky with the environments I've stepped into around that.
I think the only training you get is try not to talk when the bowler's bowling or about to bowl. So you've got to try and stop or time out, because it gives the editor a nice cut point for all the highlights. And don't stop when you hear something, because a lot of people will hesitate straight away. As soon as you hear a voice in your ear, your natural thing is to, hang on, what's the DA? What's the producer saying to me? Are they talking to me?
Yeah, that was, and especially when you come up with a really good point in the air break of when Spark or New Zealand's staying on air. And then you hear the, you know, 5-4, and you're like, geez, the rest of the world's coming in. I've got to cut this off and then start it again so the rest of the world know what I'm talking about. But I think the most impressive thing I was impressed by with my time when I did my one test was James Gemmell, when he, there's two cuts I did with him, and we had sort of like 45 seconds left. So I sort of panicked and answered the question he gave me in about 3 seconds. And felt like, and he sort of just spoke about an intro to the game and what's coming ahead and everything for about 28 seconds, and just was out perfectly. And I just stood in awe of the man, thinking like, that is incredible. And then the next day, I didn't answer the question long enough. So the next day, I answered the question too long. The producer was saying, come on, wrap it up. And then I gave James sort of 7 seconds, and he just, again, just like a perfect out. And I just was like, man, this guy is like, you know, if I was thinking to myself, geez, if I can ever get to this level, then I'd be pretty amazed. Because I remember watching Rigger once when he said on live TV, so the producer's just told me I've got 20 seconds to the out. Has anybody got anything? Okay. Well, we're at 10 seconds now, and it looks like we're going to go to an ad break. And when we come back, we'll have some live cricket for you. And it was sort of just like, you know, like, he sort of did it deliberately, and it was quite funny. Whereas sort of, I guess, like James and Sumo and that are just, they've got it down pat. So it's all about creating that rhythm as well with your production team and getting to know those people, because they're massive for you, like, you know, bringing up your data for your replays and your hotspots and your pitch maps and your Hawkeyes and all that. Like, you know, I went into the truck and asked what sort of footage I can get on the bowlers and how we could do it and try to put pieces together and stuff. So you got to look at it as a fan and how the fans would want to see it, I guess. And, you know, Baz gave me some great advice as well. Said, you know, you're a pace bowler, so just try and own that area of your expertise, and then everything else just sort of, you know, if you're with Rigger, there's no point in you talking opening batting, because, you know, he's an opening batter. Mm. And it's what the public will want to hear is Rigger talk opening batting or Fleming talk about batting. So there's no point in you sort of trying to become an expert in that. Just be an expert in your bowling and then just comment on the other stuff, but don't sort of get too deep on it. So it was something that really resonated with me. So in that test match, I could just sort of focus on what the bowlers were doing and try and add something different, I guess.
Taking you back to the coaching, who were some of the coaches that made a great impact on you? Because you've probably taken, you know, over your career, you've probably taken bits and pieces of stuff you like and chunked other things you don't like. So, yeah, who were some of the coaches that made the greatest impact on you?
I think along the way, I think every coach did, to be honest. I think every coach brought some real good stuff that you try and not steal, but, you know, you take and then try to put into your, I guess, your philosophy or your mindset as a coach. But I guess why they all stand out is probably because their work ethic as well. They were always, I think, it wouldn't matter if they were getting paid $10 an hour or, you know, $100,000 an hour. I think their work ethic would have been exactly the same, because they love the game and they're passionate about it. I had a whole different range of coaches throughout my time, and I think every one of them brought some really good stuff. Some of them did some not great stuff, but I think they're not great stuff. I think their heart was still in the right place, and they were trying to do what they tried to do for the right reasons, not for reasons that they were purposely trying to sabotage the team or trying to make your life difficult. I think they're trying to do what's best for you, but sometimes you might not agree with it, or they might not agree with the language or the way they said it to you.
You're regarded as one of the characters of the game, and you're popular in whatever team you've been selected for. You know, so many different personalities and needs in a team. So how did you balance that as a player, and you're balancing that now as a coach?
Yeah, I think straight away, if you're going to get into the head coaching, yeah, into those head coaching roles, or I guess those big director cricket roles, you know, over here where they do, you know, sort of proper contracts and negotiating money and negotiating terms and that, I think this will probably sound funny, but I think you've got to be prepared to be hated and disliked. And I think I was that when I went into those leadership roles. I was prepared not to be liked, or people might think a little bit different of you. I was prepared to do that because I felt as though I was doing it for the right reasons. I was trying to push the team forward. I was trying to make Wellington successful. And I feel as though I did that. You know, the 6 years I had there was the most successful 6 years that Wellington's ever had in their whole entire history of winning. So I feel as though that I did do that. And I think you just got to stay true to yourself, mate. Like, I think, you know, as soon as I think where people go wrong and getting head coaches roles or bigger roles, if they go from a player to a coach within a year, their outlook on the game changes and their values of the game change. I mean, like, you know, I know some people that got into coaching when I played with them, they absolutely loved the rain. They were stubborn players. So when they go to coaching the next year and they're like, oh, you know, shame it's raining, we need to be out there playing, you look at them and you think, well, you hated rain. You hated the game. Like, you know, like, or, you know, he might say, oh, this guy's stubborn, he's not open or whatever. You think to yourself, well, if a coach said that to you, you would be saying the same thing just because you're a coach now. You got to sort of, when you coach, you got to remember what it was like to be a player as well, like what sort of stress they're thinking, what they're thinking, and also what their mindset is like. And I don't think if you put that sort of coach's hat on and try and be too sort of coachy and not your sort of self, that's where I think you can go wrong in those sort of head coach roles or those coaching roles. And I think with the leadership stuff, that's what I tried to be. I still just tried to be myself. And then I guess when it was still, you know, joking and laughing and giving people some shit and stuff. But I guess when we walked across the line or when I spoke seriously, they knew that I was serious. I just tried to not talk which was how funny. I didn't try and talk serious too often, if that makes sense, because when I spoke, I wanted it to resonate and I wanted it to stay with the guys, whereas I think a lot of the time, a little bit like this interview, you can talk too much. and when you talk too much, it's sort of, you just don't, players just switch off. So whenever I do my coaching, if we have a meeting, I just try and talk at a higher level or just try and, you know, bullet point two or three things that we're working on and then disperse and then talk to guys one-on-one. Whereas I think when you sit there and you talk to guys one-on-one, or you talk to individuals, but you're in a group setting, then everyone switches off. And when you talk for 40 or half an hour or whatever it is, as a player, it feels like forever. So I just tried to talk snappy little things and just tried to make sure when I spoke that it actually had value in it. And that was the hardest thing probably for some of the, maybe for sort of like Bruce or Pockers at the time when I was captain, they'd say, we need to say this or need to say that. And I said, well, it's not the right time, or what's the point? Like, guys have heard it before. Let's just say when we need to, we don't need to talk now. Like, let's just relax. Cause I think as a coach, you can get pretty anxious as well. Like the coaches get pretty anxious cause they're nervous because they want to win or they're not sure how the group's feeling or players are feeling. So yeah, I think that's one of the biggest things for me is, yeah, be prepared not to be liked. When you talk, make sure it has value and just have trust in your guys. And if you're not, then talk to them one-on-one. Try understand where they're at.
You touched on some of your successes, Hamish. You've got 12 trophies in the cabinet in your time in the domestic competition. Any particular one extra special or something that was a bit more satisfying because you showed some resilience or you came from adversity or you had a point to prove?
Oh, they're all special in their own little way. I guess for me, the one that probably sticks out for me is the one that I was captain for, the four trophy, where you sort of sit down, Pockers and I sort of sat down when Bruce was still head coach, but Bruce gave the campaign to Glenn and he was sort of there as a selector and slash, I guess, like manager. And Pockers and I sort of ran it. And I think you sat down, you talk about what's going to happen, and we tried to play a really, I guess, different brand of cricket. We played an ultra-aggressive brand of cricket of, you know, sort of opening the bowling and having three slips and no third man and no cover and all sorts of stuff that guys would probably felt a little bit uncomfortable with. But, yeah, that was probably the one for me, the four trophy of just holding the title. And I guess I'd always tried to be a captain or have some leadership stuff in the past and got told that, no, it wasn't for me or whatever. And I think that just drove me more to do it. I think that was my personality type. If someone told me, oh, you couldn't do this or whatever, I sort of tried to go out and prove them wrong. That's what probably drove me along. So that's probably the one that springs to mind first, but they're all sort of memorable. I mean, the one that we won in Wellington against CD at Pukekura Park in my first year in T20 cricket, we just got abused the whole time. Especially from this one punter, Mean Jeets, were getting ready to bat, and he was literally right behind the rope, about a metre away from Jeets and I, just spraying us for about 20 minutes. Jeets and I actually, after the game, walked around trying to look for that guy so we could spray him back, but he'd left the ground. Probably wouldn't have remembered anyway. He looked like he'd been drinking a few days before he arrived into the ground. But I think they're all special, mate. Like, you know, the Plunkett Shields, just over time, you know, something that you just had to put so much into, so much slog to win. Whereas I guess when you win those white ball trophies, it all goes pretty fast. When by the time you wake up the next morning and you're sort of a little bit hungover and won, you sort of, the games and the nights a bit of a flash.
Your contribution to the game is much wider than that. You've got a genuine interest in the daily ongoings within the sport, which made you a really highly effective NZCPA player rep through most of your career. Now, what drove you to get into that space as well?
Well, I guess like all players, we wanted more money for a start. I can't really remember. I think, I don't know, I just think we had some, I guess, I think it was the Canterbury rep, and then we just had some stuff, I don't know, it sort of just got put on to me, I guess. At a point, I just took it when it was available and someone gave it up, and I don't know, I just really enjoyed Chander Heath and Henry about the state of the game. I think I always wanted the professionalism to be better and have, because you always want to be the best player you want to be. So I was always hot on trying to get, you know, grass wickets for longer, trying to prepare earlier, trying to get systems in place where we could actually be, you know, have the best facilities or the best people available for the whole time. And it was probably, when you think about it, it's probably from all the injuries I had, mate. I mean, you know, you're sort of waiting for, you know, sometimes waiting for scans for 2-3 weeks, and that was sort of your future. You know, you're relying on, you know, these scans and stuff to, you know, find out if you've got stress fractures or how big your tears are and everything like that. And it's sort of, I guess there was just a lot of frustration of what was happening around. So I just got involved to dig deeper, really, and ask more questions to see if we could just try and, I guess, get better quality across the board of not how we're getting treated day to day. You know, like the relationships with my MAs when he's on cricket and that have always been really good. It was more just about how can we try and make things better and try, you know, not, I don't think, ever compete with the rest of the world, because, you know, financially and with the weather that we have, and that is always going to be pretty tough. But I think we do a really good job with what we do, New Zealanders in general, like with all the sports we play, how we compete. You know, it's pretty amazing, really. When you look at Queensland, for example, where there's 200,000 more registered cricketers than New Zealand does. So,
wow.
You know, and you think that all the ICC events we've made, you know, that's from 5-year-olds to international cricket. You know, they've got 200,000 more cricketers play cricket in Queensland than in New Zealand. So you think of what, you know, we do as a country, just with our All Blacks, rugby league, netball, Olympics, Commonwealth Games, cricket. It's pretty incredible, really. So I was just trying to, I guess, get us to a higher standard day to day. And I guess, yeah, probably through my injury history, really, mate, to be honest, was something that probably drove me to do the roles in Canterbury Wellington.
It must be satisfying, having recently retired, to see the legacy that each cohort of players leaves for the next, because a lot of the stuff that, I don't know if people realise, that you're doing now is for the next lot of players.
Yeah, it is, mate. It's just one of those things. I think the game's only going to get better and bigger. So it's one of those things, you're always trying to make it bigger and better for the next generation that comes through. I think it's something that CPA have endorsed really well, and I think that the players, majority of players, understand. There's obviously some players that probably will never understand that because of just, I guess, self-interest, which was probably only natural at times. But yeah, look, you just try to make, you just want the game to be good. I mean, as a New Zealand cricketer, like you spoke about, you know, how I watch the game, I think we're all past, and, you know, I'm a past player, but even the present ones and the future ones are all disappointed about losing last night. So it's something that stays with you forever, and something that you'll always be known as, you know, like I'm known around here as the Kiwi that played cricket for New Zealand, and that will always stick for you. So, you know, as soon as I walked into the office this morning, all you get is a lot of hard lucks, you know, and it'll always stick with you. So you always want the game to be to the best of the ability it can be in NZ.
Obviously at the CPA, life after cricket is really big for us, and you've played a big role in, as a player rep, and been involved with us. In your time in Wellington and Canterbury, do you encourage a lot of the younger players or guys that are just coming through to utilise the PD program? Because there's some really, really amazing resource in there.
Yeah, look, the PD program was, I've done some of the best workshops and stuff that we've ever done in my life through that. I mean, when it first started, I think it was Sanj or Aidan Hobson maybe. He was doing everyone, so every player. So that was pretty tough for Aidan, like trying to look after 110 players. And then we had Sanj come on board, who was, you know, again, but they're still trying to look after 50 or 60 players. And then Rachel Harris came on board, who was really good. And she was looking after, you know, 40 players or something. So that was really good in my time. But I think recently, those people were outstanding. But recently, with the amount of money and funding that, I guess, the players have decided to put into that PD space through the MOU, you know, having someone like Joe Murray, for me anyway, Wellington, who just looked after Wellington and CD, was amazing. Joe was like my Wellington mum. She's someone that's, you know, personality was just built for that sort of job. You know, she's addicted to working, addicted to her laptop, just loves helping people, you know, with her daughter obviously playing at the Brisbane Heat here. You know, there's a story the other day where there's this young kid, his name was Jonty, and he's got cerebral palsy. You know, poor little guy, but a massive cricket fan. And he actually turned up in a Thunder top because of one of the Thunder players used to play for the Heat, went to his school and gave and did a speech. So Sammy Joe Johnson gave him a top with her number and his name on the bottom. And then Joe saw that and started asking him some questions. And her, the mum and the grandma drove him up 3 hours from Sydney to from New South Wales to watch the game, Brisbane, and then Joe went away. We got Mealy to get like a couple of hats and a couple of drink bottles, a couple of cricket heat balls and a top and everything signed for him and his sister, and I've actually got to post it to them. And so I think that was sort of just like someone like Joe's personality is just suited for that. That's what I guess Phil's her bucket is helping people out. And that she's been, again, like I couldn't speak how highly enough of her, of what she's done in the role and what she's doing for the other youngsters as well. I mean, you know, she's our young guys, if the young Wellington and CD players aren't using the PD program and aren't using Joe to better their lives, then they're idiots.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about cricket and growing up in Timaru. How did you get into the sport and life in Timaru as a youngster?
I think I got into it with one of my best mates in primary school. I think his dad played cricket and his brother played cricket. And I think they were short one game or something. So he said, why don't you sort of play at junior level? You know, what they call over here, they call Master Blasters or so, you know, Kiwi cricket. And I just ended up playing and then never stopped. And then just played throughout my whole sort of school. Throughout my whole sort of child playing club when I was younger, and then went to Timaru Boys, and then just kept playing. And I think things at certain times just happened for me. You know, I went to Timaru Boys and played, and then when I was fifth form or year 11, we went to Australia on a cricket tour, which was awesome. And then we came back and we played in the Christchurch schools comp for the first ever time, and we did really well. But I guess just timing was probably on my side there. You know, we started playing against kids our own age. We were competing really well. We had a good team. We had the parents involved who were outstanding. You know, they were, you know, a great group of friends that would all travel to Christchurch every second weekend or whenever we played up there to watch and support us. And that's probably something, you know, you learn, you know, as you would know, as you become a parent, of how much sacrifice you have to put into your kids' sport and making sure that they succeed. So that's one of those things at the time you probably take for granted. But when you become a parent, you realise, you know, how much their weekends they sacrifice to watch you play. And I guess that's why whenever I did play for New Zealand or played representative cricket, I guess it was, you know, you get messages from your mates and say, you know, their mum or dad passes on their regards or says, you know, congrats, and you realise it's probably just as proud a moment for them as it is for your own parents.
Have you started coaching your kids yet, or no, they're a bit little?
No, I throw a few balls to Cooper and Izzy from time to time, but I get in trouble. If the ball doesn't hit the middle of the bat, it tends to be my fault. So it doesn't last sort of that long. But, I don't know. Like, it's funny, I think they like cricket now, but they used to hate it because I was associated with me travelling, so they hated it. They're starting to come around the corner now, but they like football, so that's good. You know, they like a little bit of basketball as well, which is good. The other day, Cooper asked me if we could play rugby, so we played one-on-one bull rush, which was a bit of fun, but don't think Mum enjoyed that too much, making sure that I tackled low and looked after his noggin. But, my kids are, you know, there's so much out there now. I mean, my kids are crazy about Jurassic World. You know, they watch Jurassic World and Jurassic Park all the time. And Cooper can name every dinosaur that's ever lived on Earth and teaches me things about dinosaurs every day. So I'm just letting them do what they do, mate. I'm not too worried if they play cricket or as long as they wake up and they're happy, mate, I don't really care what they're into.
Your proudest moment?
There's probably a few moments. I mean, you know, representing New Zealand under 19s was a really proud moment for me. You know, coming from Timaru didn't really happen often, so that was a really proud moment. And then representing Canterbury as well, that was a really proud moment because, again, growing up where I grew up, that was probably the dream, watching Canterbury come to Aranga Oval once, twice a year, maybe if we're lucky, twice, or once every 2 years, and watching your heroes play. And I grew up in that era of Canterbury being, you know, so successful, winning everything, that I guess that was probably my dream growing up as a kid, was just to play for Canterbury. So that was, that was obviously a really proud moment for me. And then playing for New Zealand as well, and then also making my debut for Wellington was a really proud moment. But I guess when you make your first New Zealand side and you sort of get on the field and they can't take that game away from you, that was a really proud moment as well in all formats. So yeah, I think everyone would pick the New Zealand moment as your number one. But along the way, those moments are really big in your career, I guess, or in your stage of life.
Did you ever pinch yourself? You know, 31 matches for the Black Caps, 265 appearances, just short of 500 wickets. When you're bowling in the nets in Timaru, or when your mate sort of got you into Kiwi cricket, as you said, did you think, hey, this is where I'm going to end up?
I don't think anyone thinks like that. Well, I hope they don't when they're little. I think you should just be playing the game because you love it and you want to be like your heroes. But I think I did take the odd moment. I remember a game at Eden Park where I sort of looked around when we played India and it was as loud as anything. And I thought, you know what, this is pretty cool. Looking at everyone sort of cheering and waving at you and you're trying to get out there and play. As I got older and I realised that it wasn't going to last forever, I always tried to take a moment in those bigger games, I guess, to actually think like and look around like, this is pretty cool. Like, you know, even when I was at the Basin, when we won those back-to-back titles with the Firebirds and T20 cricket, and we had, you know, I think the second year we had a far bigger crowd because we weren't fogged in like the first year. Even then I looked around and I thought, you know what, this is pretty cool playing domestic cricket, basically having a sold-out Basin Reserve and people watching and cheering and loving cricket. I was like, whether it was only, you know, 8,000 as opposed to 35,000, it was still a great moment and moments that, you know, I was lucky enough the other day when we played the Legends League in India. We played against India and had 30,000 there watching us. And you think, geez, I wasn't as washed up as the rest of our team, but, you know, but you sort of stick around and you think to yourself, geez, this is pretty cool. You know, I've only just retired. Whereas, you know, someone like some of the other boys who are sort of like 40, you know, Jason Spice, who was 47, who played for us, you know, looking around and thinking, you know, he's got 30,000 people screaming how much they love Tendulkar or Yuvraj or something, and you're just sitting there laughing. So there's moments like that, I think. Yeah, as I got older, I really appreciate it, but you probably don't appreciate them when you're young because you think to yourself, I want to be here forever, so it's just another moment.
You touched on your injuries, mate. When I started looking through the list, you've had some majors, especially your back. That wasn't good. What happened? How did you get past it? The main one I'm referring to is that, and I saw you were quoted in the paper saying your surgeon popped down to Bunnings, picked up a couple of titanium screws and a bit of wire and put you back together.
Yeah, well, basically that was it, really. I think the only thing I didn't end up was with a concussion, so I got out not too bad. Maybe a concussion could have sorted me out. Yeah, look, I had a lot of injuries. I think with my back, it started when I was a lot younger, something that I'm doing a lot of research now with at QC around bowling, especially bowling those concrete surfaces and artificial surfaces, you know, when you're young in the nets and growing up and you sort of just bowl and bowl and bowl and people tell you if you don't bowl, you're soft and you need to keep bowling to be hard. And, you know, back in my day, I just used to bowl and all that sort of rubbish. And then I had a stress fracture that was an old stress fracture, actually. So I actually had a stress fracture for the first 7 years of my career, which wasn't great. It was undiagnosed. So from basically, yeah, 16 to 23, I had a stress fracture the whole time that just never healed. And then it healed, unfortunately, healed the wrong way. So it healed into my spinal cord. So eventually I was sort of paralyzed in my left leg as it cut my nerve off. Yeah, so I basically broke my back all the way through on my L5 there. So, and then it went into my S1 nerve root. And then so, the surgeon loved me because he used me as one of his, he went around the world talking about me, basically using my images and stuff and what he did and all that. And yeah, so it was one of his dream operations to do, you know, like someone that's really, really cooked and then get them back to playing. So yeah, so basically he just had to go in there and get rid of all the excess bone that was around my spinal cord, make sure my nerves were clear so I could walk again and not feel too sort of tingly in my legs. And then, put the screws in and put the wire in and put the rudder in and sort of send me on my way. That was only part of the journey, really. And then just as I was getting back to playing, I did a 10-centimetre tear in my quad and numerous other little niggles along the way. So it took me about close to 18 months when I was off to get back to playing. So it was probably something that I think at the end of my days, when I got a bit older, especially like now, I think that was probably what cooked me mentally. I mean, I gave up the game because I was mentally done. I think I lost my legs a little bit, definitely lost my legs. But I think if I was mentally driven enough, I could have kept playing, could have kept striving, but I was just checked out. I was done, and it was definitely from all the injuries I had. But I guess if I could do it again, and I've been asked this question once on a I did a thing for some of the Wellington young players, like a Q&A, and they sort of said, what about, you know, your injuries, what did you do? And I said, oh, I rehabbed them to the, you know, I was so detailed, and I was, you know, like I couldn't, you know, I wouldn't go, for, you know, do you want to go to the supermarket? No, I can't go for a car ride because I'm only meant to be sitting for, you know, an hour a day or whatever. So that, you know, all that sort of stuff. So I was pretty particular in all that sort of stuff around my rehab, and I think that actually cooked me. I actually was, and I'd go watch all the team trainings. I'd go to games every day when I wasn't playing, and I was. I still remember after my back op, I turned up the training 2 weeks after, walked into training 2 weeks after, and everyone was like, "What are you doing?" I was like, "We've got training," like, and I was standing there in my back. I was getting pretty sore, and my mentality was just to guts it out. And then I got back home, and I was sort of like, you know, I probably shouldn't have done that, but that was always my mentality, was to put the team first and do all that sort of stuff. And I think, like, if I'm ever a head coach and someone gets a big injury in that, I'll be telling them, like, you know, go on holiday. I do not want to see you for a month. I don't want to see you for 6 weeks. Go and go on holiday and don't worry about your injury. Like, doesn't matter if you do 6 weeks of being really particular or 6 weeks of half average stuff. You mentally, yeah, it's not going to have a bigger toll on you, as I think.
Yeah.
As you're doing it as detailed as I was, I think I'd still be playing if I was a little bit more carefree with my injuries, if that makes sense. Like, I'd still do the rehab and that, but I'd just not be as anal about it, basically.
The surgeon you're referring to is, I think it's Graham Inglis, isn't it? The
He's retired. So. He's retired now, so he's probably got some sort of house on a golf course or something, thanks to a few of us.
Hey, outside of cricket, what are you into, Hamish?
Well, I watch a bit of rugby league. I try to keep a grasp on all sort of sports, but most of my time now is taken up with kids, really, to be honest. If I'm sort of at that age where my life outside of work is irrelevant. And just, you know, whatever they want to do. You know, fortunate, obviously, in Australia with the weather, we're always at the beach or water parks or trying to explore different animals. I mean, Cooper loves going to this one park because there's all these wild kangaroos. So we just sit down and watch sort of 15, 20 wild kangaroos run around and little joeys run around and things like that. So I'm, yeah, to be honest, I'm sort of in that, I guess, in that parent rut of, not rut, but, you know, of whatever the kids want to do, I'm doing and trying to sort of entertain them. And then sort of when I get a moment, I check the cricket scores that I'm interested in. And, you know, they say football is life. I guess for me, cricket is life. And, yeah, and just try to keep an overview on all sports, really, like, you know, the All Blacks or, you know, rugby league or NBA, or watch a bit of NFL if it's on, and just little things like that, really. But listen to a lot of music. Yeah, maybe when I get a bit more time, I'd love to learn the guitar. So I'm trying to get Cooper into some music so that we can try and learn it together when he's a bit older.
You got Trent Bolt teaching you?
No, he's too good for me. When we were in the team one series, we used to talk about music and great songs, and then he would sort of go away and play them and stuff, and I would just listen and wish I could play them, or wish I could sing, or wish I had a voice that was more, well, wish I had a voice that I could sing outside of the car when I'm by myself.
In your family, you've got Leah, Cooper, Isabel, and a sausage dog. So
yeah,
most of the family has made it to Australia. What's happened to the sausage dog that you once described to me as a very stubborn German breed?
He still is. He's still a little stubborn German. No, he's going to come over once we sort of get a bit more settled and find a pad and stuff and get our lives a bit settled. Certainly been here for sort of 4 or 5 weeks. So he's with mum and dad, who didn't really like him at the start, but I think it'll be hard to get him off him now. And so now he's going good down there, but we're looking forward to getting him over. I think he'll be a big adjustment for him for the heat. So, but no, he's a good little boy. He's just, they're just hard work at the start. Anyone that's ever owned a Dachshund, they seem to be a special breed, a little bit like cricketers. There's a few characters that own Dachshunds. So, yeah, they're sort of just like each other, really. So it's been a good challenge, but he's good fun. He's nearly a year old, so apparently they calm down and get a bit less stubborn and a little bit more open-minded as they get older.
I read somewhere in an interview about you retiring, you said something like, I'm really looking forward to a little thing called Christmas and New Year's. because you don't get to do them as a player. So you got this new gig. Is that happening for you, or has Leah got to wait a bit longer to actually celebrate Christmas and New Year's with you and the family?
No, so the gig I'm in currently, I'll be able to do that, be able to enjoy some Christmas and New Year's. So that'll be good. See what it's all about. It's funny. I think it's one of those things as a cricketer, you always say, oh, I wish I had it and all that. But at the time, like, you're playing cricket, you know, the game that you love. So it's just one of those things you sacrifice and you sort of don't worry about it. Don't worry about it because you got the best lifestyle of being a cricketer and that. So I think, I'll see what it's all cracked up to be this year. Probably a better question to ask me in January.
What's coming up for you in the next little while?
Enjoy life, really. I guess just get my teeth stuck into this role here and sit down and I guess sort of try and see where I want to end up, I guess. Try and do, I guess, that life sort of smart stuff of lots of people tell you, you know, do your 5-year plan or your 10-year plan or whatever. Maybe they won't be that big of years for me of planning, but sort of sit down and think of what the end goal, I've sort of got a rough idea of what the end goal looks like and just trying to figure out that process more. To be honest, someone, I guess, here who's challenged me around that a lot is our general manager, Bennett King, who does a lot of, is our general manager of the professional side and does a little bit of, yeah, sort of like a director of cricket role. So he's challenged me on some stuff to go away and think about and do. So, yeah, just try and do that and just try and enjoy life, I guess, mate, to be honest, with no stresses of worrying about, you know, am I going to get injured or I've got to bowl tomorrow or all that sort of stuff where I need enough sleep because I've got to bowl and all that sort of rubbish. And getting back to the injury question, that's probably something that I was always paranoid probably at times about, was making sure that I was always going to be prepared well and all of that. And that's probably something my coaching that I want to get across is, you know, you just need to relax a lot and just trust what you've got. I learned that at the Legends League. I know it sounds funny, bunch of washed up cricketers, but, you know, we were arriving at games, you know, 20 minutes before the start of them, getting changed and going out and bowling from a full run up, and we were playing as serious as we could. And you sort of knew that you had the skills. You just had to almost not care about the result and just trust your skills and you'd be okay. And that was one of my biggest things I actually learnt, which was odd because you were always so worried about the result and you're so sort of tensed up. Whereas I know it's only a washed up sort of cricket league, but it was something that I took back that I would really strive for young players to listen, is just to relax and know that, yeah, it means a lot. Of course it does. But train like you care and just play like you don't. That would be my biggest advice to anyone that wants to play the game. But I just got to try. I just want to enjoy life, Dennis, to be honest. Like, there's been a lot of shit going on with COVID and all this other stuff. And so all my time's been taken up with cricket and stuff. I think I'm just trying to have some unselfish time towards my family, I guess, because I think as a sports person, you tend, whether you like it or not, you're always pretty selfish in the way that you think, or your actions are pretty selfish, not on purpose, but they're always pretty selfish around trying to be the best athlete and trying to make this team and trying to make this and trying to make that, just trying to relax and enjoy my Christmas and New Year's like we spoke about.
Hamish Bennett, thank you so much for coming on Through the Pickets. Best of luck to you, Leah, and the kids and the dog who's down in Wellington still in the new role in Queensland, and celebrating Christmas and New Year's and everything to come in the future, mate.
Cheers, mate. Appreciate that. And you're doing a good job. And I guess from my side of the CPA, I just want to say thanks for all their help and support over the years that I had. You know, I was fortunate enough to walk in when the CPA had been up for a couple of years in 2005 and met Heath in the indoor nets at the basin when he had the whiteboard out and telling us about what was going to happen and all that. So very fortunate to have been able to play when the CPA was doing their stuff. So, and obviously still, obviously a life member, so very appreciative of that as well. So well done on everyone who works for the CPA and yourself for doing this and making awareness around what the CPA does.
Through the Pickets is an NZCPA production. If you'd like to learn more about what we do and our members, make sure you follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and our website nzcpa.co.nz. If you liked our podcast, please do take a minute to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. I'm Dennis Katsanos, and you've been listening to Through the Pickets.